When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Dumbledore's big plan.
Yeah, very exciting. So, This episode will be a little bit unique compared to what you may have heard on the show so far.
It's something of a transition episode, if you will, between book one and book two, Chamber of Secrets, which chapter one will be coming out next week for that. The worst birthday.
I know, so exciting. But yeah, one of the things that we realized as we were going through the first installment is that you could probably take any one chapter from the entire saga, and there's at least a morsel that exists inside of that chapter that has contributed to a fan theory that we've created or crafted over the years.
Yeah, which is called Dumbledore's Big Plan. We've talked about it a few times in the main episodes here while we were going through Philosopher's Stone. And as you know by this point, as we're reading through the chapters, we like to sort of touch on the various theories that we've come up with over the years concerning Harry and all of his adventures. And, you know, it's fun. It's so fun, like, revisiting all, like, the little tiny, like, one-offs, because we've tackled the story from so many angles at this point. But, like, we noticed that because of the nature of it, though, that one in particular keeps coming up over and over, and that's Dumbledore's big plan, which, if you don't know, is the idea that Dumbledore has been pulling the strings on Harry's life from the very beginning. That, like, every little mystery you think Harry is solving, every little challenge he comes up against, is, at least especially in the early years, actually being orchestrated by Dumbledore behind the scenes, because the idea is that, like, if Dumbledore is the only wizard that Voldemort ever feared, and if he defeated Grindelwald, and Voldemort has fallen, but Dumbledore is certain that he'll return to power. Like, he tells McGonagall that, like, in chapter one, like, he's gonna come back. I think that much is certain. And it's like, well, then why didn't you do anything about it while he was powerless? Because, like, even his rumored location of, like, the Albanian forest or whatever is, like, accurate. Like,
it is the rumored location.
And it is where he is. And it's like, Dumbledore does nothing to go finish Voldemort off in this weakened state. And it's like, why not? And the answer is because Dumbledore alone knows the full prophecy, because Professor Trelawney made it to him. And so Dumbledore knows it's not going to be him that finishes Voldemort off. So he knows that Harry is going to be the one who has to do it, which puts Dumbledore in a very interesting position as the only character who actually knows the fullness of the prophecy. Like, should he then meddle in Harry's life and try and prepare him to take down Voldemort, or will meddling in Harry's life, like, mess with the trajectory of destiny and, like, mess it up? And, like, obviously we know he chooses to meddle. The question is then, how much does he meddle? And the answer is a lot.
Yes. Yeah. And what's really interesting to me about this is that there's this concept of for the greater good is something that we only really get introduced to to us, the reader, inside of like the main Harry Potter saga as of book 7.
Yeah.
You know, it's really what you start to discover was the underlying mantra for the mission that was shared between Gellert Grindelwald and Albus Dumbledore as two young, powerful wizards who were attempting to, you know, at that point in time, the greater good was a rather flawed argument where they were essentially saying that because of our power, that grants us the right to rule, and we will use that rule to achieve the greater good, which is basically like ascending wizard kind sort of above muggle kind, which will ultimately be better for everybody.
According to us, for
the greater good. So very frequently, and this is something that I think has puzzled me for a very long time, just as a consumer myself, the greater good can be the mantra of many villains because it's a way to make a villain in a story rather relatable. It's because for some reason or another, they think that whatever they're doing will genuinely make all of civilization better.
Right, like some bad now, greater good later.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And I think that when you take this message and you apply it to what we see Dumbledore doing and the way that he's pulling the strings with Harry, he is once again operating very frequently on behalf of the overall greater good. And I think as we embark on the full explanation, as you sort of like peel back the layers of so many of his decisions book by book, you do start to see that at times there are going to be decisions that are not good for everybody in the moment, but it is what Harry needs inside of this moment to help him be as prepared as possible to be the right person capable of taking down Voldemort. And I think through this lens, I mean, it's like anything, you know, it's maybe not excusable, but it's also more admirable than it is under the original premise.
Well, because the original premise, all of the greater good is being determined by he, Dumbledore, and Grindelwald as what they interpret the greater good to be, whereas this time the greater good is more dictated by like a prophecy.
This is something where it's like an outside actual magical force has basically determined what the eventual outcome is.
Right.
And what Dumbledore needs to do is influence it such that Harry has a fighting chance.
Right.
So as you go through the saga, and part of the reason we wanted to do this is because Dumbledore's big plan is something that, you know, we're going to find morsels inside of each chapter, inside of each book, and we want to make sure that we have explained the overarching concept as best we possibly can, so that as we hit each of those story beats, you, the listener at home, are very up to date with what we're talking
about. Right, yeah, we don't want you to feel like left out of the loop, which is not to say that, you know, proving Dumbledore's big plan is the point of Through the Gryffindor. It certainly isn't. But as we read, it's difficult for us not to like point out little things that seem to make sense from like a Harry Potter theory crafting standpoint.
Exactly.
And so we probably just will keep pointing them out, whether or not you subscribe to it. I mean, I think it's true, but
yes. And so the next thing I would say is that, yeah, we will have some, you know, light spoilers for some of our thoughts and feelings on, you know, bits of the story that will take place as we enter, you know, all the way from start to finish in the story. So if you don't want to hear those notes, then maybe tune in next week.
Yeah. I mean, if you're already familiar with Dumbledore's big plan, you probably don't need to listen to this particular episode if you don't want to, but you know, please do anyway.
Yes, indeed. But
so what we're going to do today is kind of, hit the overall beats for the entire series for Dumbledore's big plan. And then since we just finished Philosopher's Stone, we're going to dive into some of the more like nitty gritty examples inside of that book, with the tentative plan moving forward to be that after we finish any given book, we will take a deep dive into Dumbledore's big plan per the book we just finished.
Exactly. I love it.
So we'll have a transition week every time we finish a book.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yep, that is fully correct. So anyway, without any further ado, would you like to kick us off?
All right. Yes, absolutely. So I was going back through and I was reading through all of our old Dumbledore's Big Plan
scripts.
Yes. And it's so interesting like how it morphs over time, because it's especially present in the very first book for Philosopher's Stone, where it seems like Dumbledore has in each book, he has like several goals it looks like he's set out for. And along the way, he has to constantly be like in a very reactionary role, especially in books like 2 and 3. And then in like book four, you could almost call it Voldemort's big plan, because it's real. Like Dumbledore has no idea what's going on in this one. Like he has intentions for Harry, but like Voldemort is so in motion in that one that it's like, well, he is really like operating in the dark that time.
Yes, indeed. Yep, absolutely.
But so Philosopher's Stone, the main things Dumbledore is trying to do that he has been waiting for with Harry's return back to the wizarding world is, one, he does not want Harry to get sorted into Slytherin House. He wants to examine Harry's character, and he wants to test his skills and bravery, and he does all of these things in a myriad of ways.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So kind of kicking off there with Harry not being sorted into Slytherin, I suppose there's a few different ways in which this could be mildly influenced, not the least of which is quite literally sending Hagrid to be the one to collect Harry and sort of be the forerunner of the information that Harry is going to have. Because at this point in time, I mean, you can make the argument that Dumbledore knows, but Dumbledore knows what Harry doesn't know, which is literally anything at all.
Right.
And this is kind of a big deal, because when you enter any new environment, you are highly impressionable based on the first bits of information that you learn about anything.
Right. So it's and this is, I mean, Hagrid is the one, even though it is Ron in the movies, in the books, it is Hagrid who says there's not a witch or wizard who went bad that wasn't in Slytherin. And it's like, he doesn't tell him, yes, Gryffindor is good. Yes, Ravenclaw is good. Yes, Hufflepuff is good. He's real. Like, and I don't think, I think he wants Harry to end up in Gryffindor.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think he would have cared if Harry ended up in Ravenclaw or Hufflepuff. And it's not like being in Slytherin like makes you a bad person. It's just that Voldemort was in Slytherin. And the other concern is that like Harry might be some like dark wizard or something himself.
Yes.
Which I don't think Dumbledore thinks, but like he hasn't had much of a chance to examine Harry at all. And I think the further he can keep him away from like Voldemort kind of influence in Slytherin, the better.
Yes, overall. So then we, as we move forward, because this is another one of those things where it's like by the time Harry gets in that chair, he really, the sorting hat stool that is, he has one key focus, which is basically like just not Slytherin.
Not Slytherin.
Yeah. But before we get to there, we also have Harry running into none other than the Weasleys.
The Weasleys at King's Cross Station, which if now there's an argument to be made that Harry running into the Weasley, like there you always see. What always surprises me about that scene is Mrs. Weasley doesn't, she's asking, oh, what platform is it? Like, what time does the train leave? And it's like, you, like Mrs. Weasley doesn't know about platform 9 3/4. Like, yeah. Are you kidding me?
She's taking her sixth of seven children to school. And not to mention both her and Arthur went to school there.
Also went to school
and
there.
Yeah, it's always 9 3/4.
Yeah, first of all, it is always platform 9 3/4. There aren't other platforms to even choose from, and it is always at the same time. And so, like, we mapped it out. This is Molly's 17th trip to the platform for the boarding of the Hogwarts Express by the time Harry's there. So part of Dumbledore's big plan are that Molly and Arthur are sort of like his deputies, because he has pre-identified the Weasleys as, like, the perfect family for Harry to sort of be like sequestered by almost immediately upon entering the wizarding world.
Yes.
Like, because like the other thing is, he doesn't send Hagrid, you know, back to be like, here's how you get on the platform. Like, this is clearly going to be a confusing thing. And Dumbledore has sent someone to intercept him immediately and consider the children that will be attending Hogwarts from the Weasley family is, one, Percy the prefect, who is just sort of like a good, like, I mean, Percy goes on to kind of suck, but like, but at the moment, he's just like a good, like an older student you can ask questions to.
Yes.
On top of that, Fred and George, arguably the most popular students in the whole school.
Yes.
At the time. And they certainly go on to be. Right. And then Ron, who's going to be in Harry's year. Like, he is immediately surrounded, all of whom are in Gryffindor, by the way.
Yes.
So he's immediately got just like a very tentative touch point, like a system of people he can talk to and interact with.
Yes, and kind of interestingly, because you might be wondering, like, well, do we know that Dumbledore would have known Molly and Arthur Weasley? And I think the answer to that question is yes, because they do become two of the, like, you know, founding members of the second coming of the Order of the Phoenix.
Right.
Like, they're in it from the very beginning. And really the primary reason why they weren't in it the first go-round is because they were raising young children. And also, Molly's two brothers, Fabian and Gideon, were members of the Order of the Phoenix and were both killed in action.
Right.
So I think that from like an alignment standpoint, you know, like Molly would have been somebody who would have been rather tangentially related to people that he would have seen as allies the last time that Voldemort had, you know, kind of come to power.
Yes. So then on top of that, the Weasleys are also a pure blood family who don't like subscribe. Are like, you know, blood traitors, quote unquote, who don't like subscribe to any sort of pure blood superiority.
Blood traitors, AKA just good people.
Just good people. Yeah. Yeah. So they are really the perfect family for Harry to suddenly end up with. And it is almost the only explanation for why Molly pretends not to know what platform they're going towards. Cause she's not like a forgetful person.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no,
absolutely.
You know,
she's very sharp. She can take down Bellatrix Lestrange.
Yeah. So. And does. So, that's one thing is that when Harry runs into the Weasleys at King's Cross, that it feels like not an accident at all. The next big thing that Dumbledore is trying to do this year is check out Harry's character. And I'm sure we talked about this a lot in the chapter about the Mirror of Erised, but that is his big go-to move to see, like, what is Harry truly like? What is his heart's desire? And everything about the way Harry even discovers the mirror, like, suggests that Dumbledore had something to do with it. Like, it's not just random chance Harry comes across it. Like, the fact, like, Harry finds it, like, in an empty classroom during Christmas break when the other students aren't there, and it happens to be out on the night he's just received the invisibility cloak, which Dumbledore gave him and anticipates he will take out for a cruise.
The note literally says, use it well.
It says use it well. And not only that, we know that Dumbledore is in the room watching him.
Yes.
Like because he says out loud, like, back again, Harry? And he knows what Harry's seen. So it's like, Dumbledore is there. Like, he super intends for Harry to find the mirror. And it's like, And if you're wondering, the other thing is that, like, the mirror is supposed to be, like, guarding the stone. So why isn't it down? Like, they've had the stone since Harry and Hagrid picked it up that day at Gringotts.
Yes.
So, like, why isn't the mirror down at the end of the obstacle course? Like, why is he taking so long? And it's like, the reason is because he's waiting for this exact moment to see what Harry sees in the mirror.
Yes. Like, and it's over Christmas break when most students are gone. And I feel like the other thing that it really kind of does is demonstrates how Harry reflects both of the ideals of his parents in a lot of ways, because I think, like, the being given his father's own invisibility cloak speaks to the character that, like, if given the opportunity to maybe do some light rule breaking, mm-hmm. which I think is something that Dumbledore generally encourages, which we'll bring that up. We brought that up already. We will continue to bring it up as he continues to do so throughout the saga. But then I think you also get a lot of, like, Lily's character in what reflects back Harry. Like, I mean, she is just someone who loves and cares and, you know, like, puts her family first. She puts her child first. And what does Harry see inside of the mirror? His heart's greatest desire is just his family, his parents.
Right. Yeah. So it's exactly what Dumbledore is hoping he's going to see. And in fact, he does. So that's fantastic. The other reason that it might not be at the end of the obstacle course is because to this point, as the theory would go, Dumbledore is observing who Harry is becoming friends with and is intentionally tailoring the obstacle course to his friend's strengths.
Yes. So, I mean, that's one of the biggest things where it's like, there can almost be no mistake that, like, once you get down into, you know, the chambers underneath the school, I mean, for one, they've already proven themselves against the troll, which they end up not needing to face anyway. But so that one's like an easy check. Harry has become Seeker, the youngest in a century, and there happens to be a seeking-related challenge.
Yep.
We discover that Ron is uncannily good at wizard's chess, and there's a giant wizard's chess board, and Hermione is highly logical, and so she's able to take Snape's challenge and ace it with no trouble whatsoever. Like, it could not be the case that each of the challenges and the one that I like to harken back to that was more of like a through the Gryffindor discovery is I like to think that the Devil's Snare as the first challenge was intended to be because Dumbledore thought that Neville might be with them.
Yeah, I agree with you on that front, that he thought maybe Neville would be with them on this particular journey, which is why the Devil's Snare is there. As it were, the three of them just have to work together to get through it anyway.
Which is its own kind of like meaningful. Like I think it ends up working out in the end. And my suspicion is that from a writing standpoint, having a group of four became a lot more complicated than a group of three. And I would personally believe that that was the intent.
Like, right.
You know, and then it was like, this is going to be too complicated to keep up with yet another personality.
Right. But Neville, what did he do? He tried to stop him. He got 10 points.
We got it. This was the other thing, too, that, and I hadn't put it together because I hadn't looked at it through the lens in such a long period of time until our read through. But I didn't think that Neville started to come through as a standout in Herbology for at least another year. And it turns out that there actually is that line in that last chapter where even Neville aced Herbology to make up for his poor potion score or whatever.
Yeah.
Which was kind of interesting because I was like, no. From the very beginning,
like, he was good. Neville's good at Herbology.
Yeah, this is his thing. So, yeah. So anyway, I think that's the other, you know, really, really big and telling aspect. Yeah. And then Harry himself, I almost think like declares at least some concept of Dumbledore's big plan, where he basically says that, like, I think that Dumbledore thought that we deserved a chance to try.
He kind of says it.
Yeah.
You know, which is like pretty good confirmation. And the other big confirmation, I think, that Dumbledore is pulling a lot of strings, especially in the first book, is all of the things that Dumbledore does not do.
Yeah.
This is where it's like, if the other things you think, like, maybe you've sold me. Let me tell you, when you consider what Dumbledore doesn't do, that to me is almost the bigger telling point. Specifically, like, when Quirrell is trying to buck Harry off of the broom in the first Quidditch match.
Yes.
Right? Okay, yep. So, like, we know during this time that Quirrell is there watching the match, trying to jinx the broom, and that Quirrell knows, Snape knows he's doing it.
Yes.
Right? So Snape is like actively muttering a counter curse to undo whatever Quirrell is doing in the moment, which is like baffling to me, because the other thing you know about Snape is that Snape is loyal to Dumbledore to like the nth degree.
Yes.
And like even in the later books, Dumbledore says, keep an eye on Quirrell, won't you? Or whatever.
Yes.
So it's like Snape knows whose counter curse whose curse he's countering.
Yes.
Like, and it's like Snape absolutely just tells Dumbledore, like, hey, Quirrell tried to knock Harry off the broom.
It's like you know that one of our professors tried to kill one of our students? Notably the most famous of our students.
Remember when you told me to watch Quirrell? Guess what? That was a pretty good call. Yeah, right? Like Dumbledore, like, there's no way Snape doesn't tell Dumbledore that Quirrell tried to kill Harry. Nope. Like, there's no chance at all. And yet, Dumbledore does nothing about it.
Right.
Because he doesn't care. Not that he doesn't care, but because he wants the events that end up playing out to play out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think in my mind, and it's hard to know exactly to what extent Dumbledore would know this. So it's, some of it's just speculation. But like, in my mind, I think that Dumbledore is at least somewhat aware that, I don't know if he quite knows that like Voldemort is living on the back of Quirrell's head, but I think he's pretty aware of the fact that Quirrell is being influenced by
Voldemort.
By Voldemort, yeah, at this point in time. And so the obvious thing to do would just be to sack him.
Yes.
Just get him as far away from the school as possible. And if he's not doing that, it must mean that for some reason Dumbledore, especially because he also ends up letting an 11-year-old barely trained Harry go up against him at the end of the year, it must be on some level that Dumbledore doesn't think he's quite a huge threat yet. Like he might know that this is like the mist like form that has returned, that like maybe he's coming out of hiding, but like where we're at in the stage right now, I think Dumbledore is able to surmise enough to know that we're not quite at like danger point.
Right.
Like there's not that much that Voldemort can truly do against Harry so far.
Right. The other thing along the same lines as Snape, or like clearly Dumbledore clearly knowing Quirrell is up to doing, is on Halloween when the troll gets in. There's two points here. One is that Snape gets bitten by Fluffy on this night. Like, he goes to head off Quirrell, who has let the troll in as a distraction so he can go try and see what's guarding the stone. Snape heads him off, meaning that Snape is successful in heading him off,
yeah,
because Snape gets bit by Fluffy.
Right.
So it's like he absolutely again tells Dumbledore, like, hey, guess what? Guess who was trying to get past the dog? It was Quirrell. Again, nothing is done. On top of that, Like when from Harry and Ron's point of view and you, the reader's point of view, you don't know that Quirrell is good with trolls or anything like that.
Right.
Like until the very end of the book. But if you're Dumbledore, then the fact that a troll got let in and that you know that Quirrell is good with trolls because Quirrell gave you a troll to guard the stone, like it's plain as day who let the troll in.
Yes. It's like, and it's like, hold on, let me check my notes really quick. I'm pretty sure a troll came up recently. Okay, we got Devil's Snare, we got Flying Keys, we got Chessboard. Oh yeah, we have a troll on the list. That's weird.
Right. Especially, you know, like, who does Quirrell think he's kidding? Why is he, like, Quirrell is apparently great at defeating trolls. He's good with trolls, so he runs in all afraid of it. Like, Dumbledore should be like, aren't you supposed to be super good at this?
I know, yeah. What should have happened in real life is Quirrell should have handled the troll with no issues whatsoever and then just gone up and whispered in Dumbledore's ear and been like, hey, by the way, on the third floor, there's a troll.
There's a troll.
I took it out. So don't worry about it. It's locked safely in a room. Nobody's going to get hurt.
Right.
But like, you know, everything's fine. But no. He's in there like freaking out. And Dumbledore, of course, is like, I'm looking right through you.
They're like, I know exactly what's up right here.
Yes. Snape. Hey. Head that way.
Yo.
You know where to be,
so
right?
The other thing, and this is like, so there's a couple more things here that are like maybe Dumbledore is pulling the strings, is that like it just so happens that on the very day Hagrid goes to pick up Harry, Dumbledore also instructs Hagrid to go to Gringotts and retrieve the stone.
Yeah.
Thus allowing Harry to put two and two together later to figure out like, hey, wait a minute.
Didn't we get something special?
Like Harry is uniquely able to identify that like the vault, like Gringotts was attempted to be robbed and that the vault was emptied like the same day. I mean, it's convenient that the goblins phrase it that way, but like it is because of Dumbledore's specific instructions to Hagrid on that day that Harry is able to connect the Sorcerer's Stone to the robbing at Gringotts. Which is interesting. And then, too, this is what always, like, it's innocuous when you read it, which is makes it smart by Dumbledore. But at the beginning of the year, he just says that the third floor corridor on the left-hand side is out of bounds to anyone who does not wish to die a most gruesome death. And it's like, look. If you're trying to hide something, don't tell everyone exactly where it's hidden.
And then if you're gonna guard that door, make it more blocked than just simply Alohomora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like if your real goal is to guard the stone, then you don't tell people not to go in the door. You just lock the door and make the door itself really hard to get through.
Yeah.
Like in year five, Umbridge like is able to magically seal her door against the Alohomora, and that's Umbridge. Okay, like she's not great. Dumbledore can 1000% make this door unopenable to students.
Yes,
right. Like and then just not tell them, because then what? It's not like people are going to accidentally wander through a magically sealed locked door.
Yeah,
because they can't.
Right,
they won't be able to.
And then there's the stone itself, which is what all of this stuff is guarding. And there's a couple of different thoughts here, which is that like by the end of the story, they destroy the stone anyway, which is like, which kind of makes me think that it's just like a lure that's been used the entire time just to entice Voldemort out of hiding.
Right.
Because it's sort of like, hey, we've got this magical object. It appears to, you know, like it's making headlines. It's blah, blah, blah. But the other thing that's kind of interesting about it that is just simply the fact that I think Nicholas Flamel is 665 years old. And it's kind of interesting that like this so happens to be the year that he is willing to like part with the most important magical creation that he's ever, like that his entire life, his 665 year long life revolves around the creation of this one particular alchemical like thing. There is one of them, as far as we know, hard stop.
And it's not like it's not like Dumbledore has any much, like, has to, like, talk him into it. It just seems like Flamel's like, you know what? It's fine.
I like to think that, yeah, Flamel was basically like, I'm ready.
Yeah. Like, I think he was ready before it was almost stolen.
Yes.
And, like, to that end, it's like when you watch Fantastic Beasts, like, Flamel's keeping the stone at his house. And already, he's not even keeping the stone with him anymore.
Sure.
You know? Like, it's already been removed from his person. If he needs Elixir of Life on the fly, not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, he's already got to go all the way to Gringotts to get the stone. Like, it's like, they could have destroyed it. That's the thing. They could have destroyed it immediately.
Yes.
They didn't need to guard it. They could always have just destroyed it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's rather fitting as well, too, because it would bookend so tremendously nicely, because so much of the themes of this story have to do and revolve with the concept of death.
And like accepting it.
And accepting death. And so for it to be the case that the one mortal person who genuinely achieved some version of immortality basically closes out the first installment of the story by accepting his own, you know, fate.
Right.
It's like, I mean, it fits with the themes of the overall narrative so well. It is so contrary to what Voldemort himself exists and lives for, which is immortality.
Right.
So it all fits together just like so perfectly.
Right.
So I don't think that Dumbledore had to have a difficult conversation with Flamel after Harry successfully retrieved the stone from the mirror at the end of the story. I think at that point in time, Flamel had already more than accepted, like, okay.
Yeah.
I am.
It feels
point.
To me like Dumbledore and Flamel had a conversation earlier in life, and Flamel's like, I think I'm ready to destroy the stone. Like, it's just, you know, I'm ready for the next thing. And Dumbledore was like, well, if you're going to destroy it, I've got this project I'm working on.
I've got a thing. Yeah. It can be useful.
Hold on. Give me one more year.
Yeah.
I have an idea.
So that is book one. Kind of in a nutshell. And book one has a lot going on because there's a lot of setup. There's a lot of like, you know, leading us into everything. But from there, I think we can transition a little bit into Dumbledore has one. There's one massive discovery and one key decision that he makes in Chamber of Secrets.
Right.
And one of them has to do with what will eventually be the discovery to the downfall of Lord Voldemort, which actually comes thanks to information from Harry. And the other has to do with helping protect Harry from who he could become.
Yes, exactly. So we're not going to be as like nitty gritty with the rest of the books here, but we do want to give you like a brief, like, here's what's happening. So when we bring it up later on, when we're reading Chamber or Prisoner or whatever, you can kind of be like on the lookout.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So the big one in Chamber of Secrets, Dumbledore is acting in a much more reactionary role in this one, because it's not like he's planning for the Chamber of Secrets to be opened and for the basilisk to be on the loose. He has to deal with that on the fly.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's one we're going to talk a little bit about the greater good and a little bit of the sacrificing the well-being of others in the name of saving people. I don't think that Dumbledore includes setting a basilisk on the school on that list.
Yeah, no.
So he's not doing that on purpose.
No, he's not doing that on purpose. But something he is willing to sacrifice in the name of the greater good is every other student's defense against the dark arts education that year, because the main lesson he seems to be setting out to teach Harry this year is what not to become.
Yes.
And the way he does that is by hiring Gilderoy Lockhart, just a complete buffoon, to teach the students really nothing the whole year.
Yes. So the thing about Lockhart, especially as he's first introduced to us, is and I mean, part of the eventual twist is that he's just kind of inept. He is not the character of his stories. He has completely fabricated everything. But I mean, he's otherwise just a moron. And the rest of the teachers seem to know it clear as day.
Yeah.
Like nobody, like none of the teachers are being fooled, because they're all talented witches and wizards.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing and they know he doesn't.
Right. I mean, even at the end when they reveal that, like, you know, Lockhart erased his own memory, Dumbledore says, impaled upon your own soul, Gilderoy. And it's like, yeah, you knew the whole time.
Yeah,
why did you hire him? What are you doing?
Right. And the reason why he hired him is because Harry is basically fresh into the wizarding world. He's just learned the first little tidbits about who he actually is. He was drafted as the first ever, or the youngest Quidditch player in a century, where he then went on to be excellent in every game he was capable of playing. He was able to not only defeat Voldemort, but lead Gryffindor to their first House Cup in 7 years.
Yeah.
Minimum.
Right. Like he walks into the wizarding world already famous for having defeated Voldemort and exits Hogwarts year one having done it again.
Yeah, he's basically a hero.
Right.
And so what you have to be cautious of at this point in time is kind of the influence that you may have seen on characters like Draco Malfoy or Dudley Dursley, which is that, like, if everybody in your life tells you that you're the most special thing that ever lived, walked, breathed, then you might start to think so yourself.
You might start to act that way. You might start acting like Lockhart. You might, like, start getting a very big hag about yourself and just thinking you're great because everyone says you're great, and guess no one's going to have any... like, as far as Dumbledore knows, there's not going to be an attack by Voldemort this year. The chamber's not going to get opened.
Right.
You know, Harry's just going to walk in as basically the most popular kid in school who's also super famous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So he's trying to head that off by showing Harry the dangers of fame and the ways in which not to become.
Exactly.
At the cost of everyone else's education for a year.
For a year. Yeah. Yep, that's exactly it. So basically Harry can see Lockhart and basically see that this is somebody who I do not want to model my own behavior after. But either which way, it doesn't end up being the most popular year for Harry because half of the school, the whole school rather, discovers that he's in fact a parcel mouth and capable of speaking to snakes. And when there is blood being written on the wall saying, like, enemy of the air, beware. It's not a good look.
No, it is not a good look at all. I will say that this is maybe a good, as we're talking about Lockhart, this might be a really good time to remind you guys that we have just launched a brand new product that I would be excited to tell you about right now. It is over at wizardingcandles.com. But yeah. Ben and I have launched, we've been coming up with this for like the past several months, and I'm so excited it's finally launching. But it is our Wizard Candle Club, and the way it is going to work is that every single month we will have a brand new scent, and if you head over to wizardingcandles.com, you can like sign up for a year-long subscription, and each month you'll get a brand new mystery, magically inspired scent. The first one is called Pretty Obvious, and it smells like lilac, and I mean, it smells so good. We were burning it in the office earlier, and God, last week I was still recovering from COVID, and they finally had the candles and I could not smell them at all.
I know, the worst.
I know.
The worst.
And I walked into the office this week and was like, what's that smell? I was like, oh, it's the candles. It's so good.
Is this totally glorious? It is.
It is. Yeah. So
Gilderoyous.
Yeah. <There's> Gilderlorious?
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. I was like, there's a pun in there somewhere.
There's a pun in there. That's the first candle that is available now. And what makes the candles extra fun is that as they burn down, when you get to the bottom, after all the wax is gone, you can collect an exclusive little silver charm out of the bottom of each of them.
They're so fun.
And so you can collect all 12 by the end of the year. And those are also just for what you can like wonder what's it going to be. So if you want to check those out, go do it. The first one is called Pretty Obvious. It smells like lilac. It smells amazing. And there's a fun charm inside.
Yeah, wizardingcandles.com.
All right.
Definitely go and scope it out. Yeah. So as we kind of close out Chamber of Secrets, the other really big discovery happens. And this is less Dumbledore's big plan, but just kind of essential to the overall narrative, which is the discovery of Tom Riddle's diary, which tells Dumbledore the vital piece of information that what... Tom Riddle has clearly done in life in order to protect him from death is the creation of small trophies that he is able to store bits of his soul inside of.
Yes.
And it indicates that this could be the pathway to his ultimate destruction.
Yes. The other thing Dumbledore personally learns in this one, though, in that Voldemort has created Horcruxes, is that Harry himself is a Horcrux, which is a new problem Dumbledore is going to have to solve, because it means that Dumbledore at this point has realized that Harry is going to have to die in order for Voldemort to be defeated.
Yes.
And this is like one of those greater good moments where he's like, Harry is the only one who can defeat him. And now it is also going to involve him dying. So that is like, what do I do? Like at this point, like he doesn't have a way out yet. He just sort of has to trust that the more good he puts out, like a solution will present itself, which it eventually does. But like between specifically books 2 and 3, like there's that sentiment from Snape that's like, you've been raising him as a pig for slaughter. And it's like from books 2 to 3, like to the end of 4 even, that is sort of what's happening.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a really big one, but it also makes for one of the most impactful and important sentences of the entire series happens towards the end of Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, but we'll get to that in a second, because next let's talk about Prisoner of Azkaban and sort of the big themes to be on the lookout in there.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pay
Hair Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Griffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Hair Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped because like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing in. I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think honestly kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to paireyewear.com and use code Griffin for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's paireyewear.com, code Griffin.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So the thing about this book, which you have to realize going in, is that whilst this is a theory about Dumbledore sort of pulling the strings and knowing everything, he still doesn't know everything. So when you think about Dumbledore's big plan going into Prisoner One, you have to remember that Dumbledore does believe Sirius was the Potter's secret keeper. So he does think Sirius broke out to kill Harry. He does not magically know that Sirius is innocent.
Right.
And two, he also did not know that the Marauders were Animagus, but he does know that Lupin is a werewolf.
Yes, indeed.
So,
As we sort of step into this one of the really big things is going to be the hiring of Remus Lupin.
Yep.
And also the teaching of Harry how to do a Patronus and what is his greatest fear.
Yeah, so those are sort of the big themes here, because Dumbledore, like when Voldemort does come back, I think the literal very first thing he tells Fudge to do is like, you have got to like take over Azkaban from the Dementors. We cannot ally ourselves with them. Bad news, Dementors. Like,
yes.
He has identified way ahead of time that like the moment Voldemort comes back, he's going to get the Dementors. And that's going to be a big problem, if not the biggest problem.
Yes.
Like, possibly worse than the Death Eaters, who will then also escape if they're gone. But, like, he knows that they are a big deal. So he's like, all right, Harry, let's go ahead and teach you something about Dementors, because inevitably they're going to play a role.
Yes, 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 yes. Because that's like one of those things is that like the Patronus Charm in general is one of Harry's most iconic and famous spells.
Yeah.
Like second only to Expelliarmus, even if it even is second to Expelliarmus as its most iconic spell. Because it is the one that I think demonstrates his prowess the most.
Yeah.
Is it seems like anybody who knows that he can make a corporeal Patronus is impressed.
Yeah.
With what he's capable of.
I mean, it's more of his signature spell. Like, he learns Expelliarmus in Chamber of Secrets, but then, like, he doesn't put it to, like, tremendous use until Goblet of Fire. But sure. In the meantime, the Patronus Charm is, like, his big spell.
Yes.
That he learns how to do first.
Yes.
Even if Expelliarmus goes on to become more of his signature spell in the future. But, like, what it... not that it works out that someone breaks out of Azkaban, but it does work out in that, like, I think Dumbledore always intended for the Boggart lesson to happen so that he could learn Harry's greatest fear.
Yes.
So that he could be armed for Dementors. As it were, Harry just, you know, fortunately, quote unquote, runs into a Dementor on the way to school that year.
Right.
Yeah. So, but I think Harry's greatest fear, I think it would have manifested as a Dementor either way.
Sure, yeah, no, yeah. I agree with you, because I think that sort of goes back to that. It's actually a film line and not a book line, but it's this suggests the thing you fear the most is fear itself.
Yeah.
Which we've gone pretty deep into that particular topic as well in a video, but it's pretty interesting. But, the other thing I was going to say about the Patronus in general, though, is it's kind of a niche spell.
Yeah.
Aside from being used to attack Dementors, which obviously Dumbledore knows the exact application this will eventually be useful for Harry for when Voldemort takes the Dementors on his side, but learning that spell as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Deeply, vitally important.
Vitally important. So I think Dumbledore always intended Harry to learn about the Patronus Charm this year. And I think the hiring of Lupin in particular is also no accident as it comes to Harry, because Lupin is someone who is like he's going to teach him about Patronuses, which he's like extremely pure of heart despite being an outcast person himself.
Yes.
So it's like the ability, it's also sort of teaching Harry about like the power of like a good soul.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And then speaking of souls, I think the value like that any one person has on a soul or even just the value of overall innocence, are things that I think end up being just very, very, very crucial themes. Again, as we kind of trudge forward, we see it like with the links that Dumbledore goes to in order to arrange Snape's killing of himself rather than Draco, literally in the name of protecting the sanctity and purity of Draco's soul. So
right.
He doesn't have to sever his own just to save his own family, which is basically what Draco ends up being.
Yeah, and even asking Snape to do it, Snape's like, well, what about my soul? And Dumbledore's response is like, if you think helping out fulfilling the dying request of a friend will split your soul, you know, that's up to you to decide. But right, it's like, right. Dumbledore doesn't think that Snape's soul will be split because he's not murdering him. He's like mercy killing him.
Exactly.
At his request, basically.
At his request, yeah. So there's much more involved with it, and Snape can be entitled to that information in a way that Draco can't be trusted with.
Right.
Yeah. Which is the one thing. And then the other, on the flip end of that, I think that at this point in time, again, we're right on the heels of Dumbledore discovering that the diary, and with the diary is the realization that Voldemort has clearly made not just one Horcrux, but potentially more Horcruxes.
At least two, if he has the diary and Harry.
Yes. Yes. And so the other thing that Harry's going to learn a lot of in this year is again the importance of and the wholeness of a soul, which is in steep contrast to Voldemort, who willingly ripped his own
right, yes.
into unrecognizable shreds.
Yeah, and more of that comes back into play then in book 7 as well, which we'll get to in a little bit here. But moving on, then we have year 4, where again, Dumbledore is way more in the dark in this one. You can see maybe what he was setting out to do, but almost right away, none of his plans are working out this year the way he wanted to. But the big thing he wants Harry to learn this year is just like unity, more or less, not amongst wizards of all kinds and backgrounds, and then all, And just basically the power of unity amongst wizards, I think.
Yeah, because we see it a couple of different ways. I mean, the first and foremost, there's the going to the Quidditch World Cup.
Right.
Which is going to be exposing Harry not just to wizards of, you know, like Great Britain and Ireland, but like much, much, much further beyond those reaches.
Right.
And kind of demonstrating that there is a huge wizarding population in lots of parts of the world.
Right. All of whom could be at threat to Voldemort.
Exactly.
Right. It's not just like Hogwarts and you, Harry, that's, you know, potentially at stake. Like, this is everything. This is everyone.
Yes.
You know, so you get to see that and see just what wizard culture looks like up close. And the theory, the way in which Dumbledore is manipulating this, is the theory goes that because Dumbledore is planning the Triwizard Tournament with Ludo Bagman and like Barty Crouch of the Ministry or whatever, that like he is the one who persuades Ludo Bagman to give Arthur the tickets to the top box where they are then also able to invite Harry to come to the Quidditch World Cup, because it is vital for Harry to simply experience and witness the togetherness of cultures at the World Cup.
Yeah, and I mean, when it comes to asking Harry to eventually die on behalf of all of these people, being able to go and see those people, you know, in such a joyous occasion, is something that I think is really, really helpful in kind of constructing for Harry, you know, this you know, I don't want to call it like his sense of responsibility, but who he's fighting for.
Right, exactly.
You know, is I think a huge part of it. And then beyond that, we also know that it's not just the Quidditch World Cup that he's going to get exposure to this year. It's also, again, what you said already, the Triwizard Tournament,
right,
which is something that they've brought back from, you know, like the dark days, basically. Like this is something where they got rid of it because too many people were dying.
Right. And Dumbledore was like, let's bring it back. We'll do it at Hogwarts. It's fine.
Where of course Hermione, I think, understands it the best, which is that like this is an opportunity for us to get to know and to, like, you know, understand and make friendships with people from all over the world, which she embraces very fully. Like, I think she sees that it's not just about the competition and glory.
Oh, she absolutely understands it in a way that the other two, or Ron and Harry, don't,
are missing
off the gate. But like, if you think about what Dumbledore was hoping for, because, like, again, Dumbledore is not planning on Harry's name ending up in the Goblet of Fire. He doesn't go into the year thinking, yes, I want Harry to play in the Triwizard Tournament. He wants Harry to observe the Triwizard Tournament and get to know wizards from other places and get new points of view.
Yes.
First and foremost. But the other thing that would have happened without Voldemort's interfering is that Cedric would have been named school champion, and everyone at Hogwarts would have been united in supporting Cedric, which is really, really the lesson I think Dumbledore wanted, is that specifically Gryffindors and Slytherins would have had a shared thing they were rooting
to come together for.
To come together for. Instead, this blows up in his face big time because Harry ends up in the Triwizard Tournament and the houses are like divided more than ever. So really backfires on him. But that you can imagine is his plan going in, that the whole school will have to be united because the quote unquote enemy will be the other two schools, not the houses for once.
Yes. But the reason that it goes wrong is because of the other big decision that I think, you know, that Dumbledore was attempting to do this year that might make up for, you know, his year two schooling, which is Professor Lockhart being there for that period of time, which, by the way, going back to that just really quickly, those poor students in fifth year who were going into their OWLs.
Oh,
just
I know.
Got terrible education.
Terrible.
That sucks so bad. But anyway, so he's attempting to make up for it in some capacity by bringing like the polar opposite for the Defense Against the Dark Arts position, which is going to be Alistair Moody.
Yeah.
However, the thing he is not privy to, not part of Dumbledore's big plan, is that Voldemort got there first.
Voldemort gets there first and replaces Moody with an imposter.
Yes.
Who then, it's like, this is one of those weird things, but it's like, the Moody's classes, despite it being Barty Crouch Jr., end up still being super popular, even though he's performing like the
Imperious Curse
on the students. And it's like, if you think, like, does Dumbledore is he okay with it? And it's like, yeah, well, he must be okay, because it's like the moment Moody's classes start, like it is the buzz of the whole school. Like yes. Everyone knows what's happening in there, and he doesn't stop it. And it's like, why? Think about what that means. It's like Dumbledore is okay with the students being put under the Imperius curse. And it's like, why? Because he knows that Harry is going to have to come up against it. He's going to have to like recognize when people are underneath it. And indeed he does, because like eventually he's able to recognize one that Stan Shunpike is under the Imperius curse and doesn't kill him, which is good.
Yeah.
Even though he has this weird fixation on Stan, but that's a whole different thing.
That's a whole different thing.
And in the meantime, it allows Harry, like Dumbledore already knows that Harry has like, you know, tremendous resolve having seen what he sees in the mirror and stuff like that. But he is like, I think he thinks it's probably good for Harry to have a few practice sessions under the Imperius curse.
Yes.
Heading into, which then also pays off when Voldemort tries to cast it on him in the graveyard later in this very book, and he just shakes him right off.
Yes, yes. So Harry's super capable in that regard. But then, so obviously at this point in time, we get to the end of the saga, and the Triwizard Cup has now been turned into a portkey. Harry is headed off to the graveyard, where he has to face down Voldemort. Again, not something that Dumbledore ever intended to happen. However, does come with one of the most essential pieces at this point in time, you know, where Dumbledore has now spent the last 3 years basically believing that Harry is going to have to die. We basically learn, or Dumbledore learns, that because Voldemort took Harry's own blood back in his revival, there's the one line I was talking about earlier. It's the gleam of triumph that Harry thinks he witnesses in Dumbledore's eyes. And that is the moment. And you have to get inside of Dumbledore's like headspace to just even begin to appreciate the importance of that moment to him, because he is like helping this kid. He's trying to teach them. He knows the mantle that has been placed upon his shoulders. He knows the difficulty of life that he's already had to face, everything that he has been through. And this moment in particular, he realizes Harry gets to live.
Right.
Harry gets to live.
He has a way out.
But I can't tell him that.
Right.
And it's like, so it's like, that's why it's like a flash and then it's gone moment. And it's one of my favorite moments of the whole story, is just because it's like, in that second, he gets to have this tiny, enormous moment of victory.
Yes.
But he won't even get to see it play out.
He's not even going to see it play out. No, he will not. And he has a whole plan for how he's going to do it anyway. We can talk about that in a second. But that takes us to year 5, where if you don't think this is, again, it's a great example of, you can see Dumbledore's big plan in action better in the things he doesn't do.
Yes.
I think in particular, because
for sure.
Yeah. Because what happens in year 5 is that even though Voldemort came back, he's not like the main antagonist in this book somehow, because Umbridge shows up, which says a lot about her. But here's the thing. The reason Umbridge is a professor at all at Hogwarts, I believe, is because of Education Decree 22. So whatever the first one is.
Yeah.
That basically says that if the headmaster is unable to find a suitable candidate for defense for a position, then the ministry may appoint one. And it's like, okay, so apparently Dumbledore finally couldn't find a defense against the dark arts professor, so the ministry appoints Umbridge, which would be a totally viable explanation, except that the title of this book is called The Order of the Phoenix,
which is quite literally a small legion of defense against the dark arts oriented wizards.
Exactly.
All of whom have committed their lives to helping this exact cause.
Two of whom were already hired for this exact position.
Yes.
Like Lupin and Moody are members of the order. So it's like, the idea that Dumbledore couldn't find someone to teach this class is absolutely bonkers and bananas. Like, he absolutely can't. And here's the thing. It's like, you might think, maybe they have more important things to do. And it's like, he's teaching the students, all of the students, the seventh years, the sixth years, defense against the dark arts. Like, the most important class in a world that Voldemort exists in. And he just chooses not to fill that role. He doesn't even have to ask for volunteers, right? These are members of the order. He's the leader. He can just tell them,
this assignment
is your job. This is how you will be serving the order,
right?
Is by coming to the school and educating the students the best you can do. Like, the fact that Dumbledore can't find a teacher is just patently false because he has a whole group of people who could absolutely do it. And he chooses not to fill the role, which means he wants the ministry to appoint someone. And because the main thing he is trying to teach Harry this year is that you cannot trust the ministry. Like, when it is down to you and Voldemort, it is down to you.
Yes.
Like, you cannot rely on them. They are corrupt. And like, this is what you have to learn this year. And it's like, it's going to suck. Maybe he didn't realize how much it was going to be bad. Like, maybe he didn't just made Umbridge bad, but like, this is the lesson.
Yes. And I think it's even teed up a fair bit at the end of Goblet of Fire, just a like sort of inch, just terribly close to the end of the book there, where there's a big conversation between Dumbledore and Fudge that Harry overhears all of, but
yeah.
it's basically just Fudge being like, no, I'm not going to scare people into thinking that Voldemort's back. I'm not going to do it. And Dumbledore's like, you need to, like, this is about to go down. And if you don't, then bad things are going to happen. So yeah, I think that the inclusion of Umbridge is a massive representation as to what Harry needs to learn about the greater world that he lives in. Because it is so easy for any of us to think that, like, you know, someone higher above me is capable of solving this greater threat to myself.
Right, like you can see from Dumbledore's point of view, because Dumbledore knows he won't be around at the end.
Yes.
Well, maybe at this point he doesn't, but like...
Oh, yes, he hasn't put the ring on yet.
He hasn't put the ring on yet, yeah. but he knows, if you're Harry, like, the desire to, like, ask for help from someone greater, like the government, you know, like, that's going to be real tempting, and it's like, you cannot do that. You absolutely can't. Like, you basically, it will be down to you, and you need to be able to trust your own instincts on it.
Yes. Yeah. Yep, exactly. And I think the other really case in point is, in my personal opinion, is the fact that, like, apparently he can't find a defense against the Dark Arts professor, but then when Trelawney is sacked because Umbridge has assumed enough power to do that, he is able to then bring in Ferenczi immediately, despite the fact that this probably means exile for him,
right?
You know, by coming to teach this particular position. So it's like that, like, Dumbledore is willing to, I mean, I'm sure everybody owes Dumbledore a favor in some capacity, or people are just willing to help him because they believe in his overall cause.
Yeah.
But like, to me, that says, like, if he was able to go to the centaurs, who are typically at this point in the story not aligned, you know, with like, they're not really aligned with anybody. They're right. just sort of like removed themselves from the situation. If somebody from that populace is willing to come and help the cause, then I have to believe that any other person that Dumbledore had, Arthur Weasley, could have come and taught defense against the dark arts.
For
goodness sake. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, anybody could have done it. So yeah, no, absolutely. Umbridge, intentional, allow Harry to see what's going on and go from there.
Exactly. Which brings us to year six. And this one is just super duper easy because it's like, there's no hiding it anymore. There's no, it's like in the other books, it's very much like, how is Dumbledore pulling the strings and instructing Harry in ways that he can't even see? And it's like, this one, the gloves are off. Like, Dumbledore is taking the direction directly into his hands.
Yes.
I don't have to tell you what Dumbledore's big plan is here. This is just what the book is. He's telling him directly how to defeat Voldemort and showing him basically that, like, by learning about your enemy's past, you can uncover the secrets as to defeat him. Something Voldemort absolutely does not do to his own demise over and over and over again.
Yes.
Because he thinks he understands Harry, but doesn't. Like, when he think, like, the great example is, like, at the very end when Harry walks into the forest, like, Voldemort thinks he's doing it out of, like, fear and selfishness. He cannot comprehend at all that Harry could possibly be doing this out of selflessness, or at all that he's packing a way to defeat him.
Yes, yes, exactly. And one of the big things is that, like, you know, and again, a central theme to the overall story is just love. You know, it's like, it's one of the most important aspects. And Dumbledore does have a rather heated discussion with Harry where he's like, you can love. And Harry's like, big deal.
Right.
You know? It's like, but like, this is like one of those,
it's like things, so second nature to him.
Yes, exactly. It's like, Harry's like,
I can breathe too. What do you want from me?
Right, right. It's like, this is not like, I want to believe that I have like an uncanny ability that will help me in this fight. And it's like, that's not what it is. It's so much more human than that, which I do love about the story overall, because it's something we're all capable of. It's like, Harry doesn't have a superpower. He can do what we can all do, which is an amazing thing. But one of the things I think is kind of neat about when that particular discussion happened happens is that Harry goes to his office. He's having this big discussion. He's having like that like big deal moment, like I can love, whatever. It's the very next chapter in the story when Harry and Ginny find, like, where he goes back to the portrait hole. He doesn't know who won the Gryffindor Quidditch game, and the door opens and there's celebrations everywhere, and Ginny comes and runs into his arms, and he has like his first moment with who will eventually go on to be his wife.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's like, yes, you can love, and like
Dumbledore said.
Right. Yeah. gave him permission, I guess. But not that I think that Ginny loving Harry is part of Dumbledore's big plan, but I do think the timing is rather remarkable.
That's right there. He's like, okay, maybe I should give into this.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So there's that. And then that'll bring us into book 7. And this one's a really tricky one because obviously Dumbledore's dead.
Yes.
So it's like, what could his plan, what plans could he possibly still be enacting? And at this point, we've talked about how in book 4, Dumbledore recognized that there was that like, oh, Harry has a way to live.
Yes.
He has a way to come back because now Voldemort will tether him to life as like the love crux or whatever.
Yes.
The problem Dumbledore is now facing, and this is just like reinforcing some of the other themes, is that Harry is still going to have to be the one to finish off Voldemort, which means that like there's almost no way for the story to end without Harry becoming a murderer. So like what can Dumbledore do to stop
purity of soul again?
Yes, because if he becomes a murderer, if he even by killing Voldemort, it will rip Harry's soul. So what can Dumbledore do to protect Harry's soul from being ripped? Like, his body will live on. He's confident in that. But like, how will he be protecting Harry's soul? And the plan he comes up with when you like peel it back, I think we have to like piece it together a little bit and do some guesswork, but I think it makes such good sense.
Yes.
And so
I agree.
When he's talking to Harry in King's Cross after Harry's died, Harry confirms with Dumbledore that like he planned for Snape to kill him, and he therefore planned for Snape to become the master of the Elder Wand. And Dumbledore confirms, yes, that was my plan.
Yes.
However, in that same conversation, he reveals that he was certain that Voldemort was going to go after the Elder Wand.
Which means that he basically thinks that he's almost certain that Voldemort will end up attempting to kill Snape.
Yes. Which means he is like positive that Voldemort is going to try and kill Snape. Like, he basically sentenced him to death, whether or not he tells Snape that or not, which seems like, okay, so that's bad news because it means that he thinks that Voldemort is going to get the wand and that'll be bad. However, the other piece of the puzzle is the Sword of Gryffindor, so our theory goes that Dumbledore's plan was for Snape to give Harry the sword, which he eventually does.
He does.
But that the portrait reminds him it must be taken under like, you know, bravery or whatever.
Yeah,
conditions of valor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the plan, we think, was that Snape was going to appear to Harry carrying the sword and apparently try to attack him.
Yeah.
And from Harry's point of view, this is the guy who killed Dumbledore. And now he has the audacity to be trying to attack me with the Sword of Gryffindor that Dumbledore left me in the will? Like, which was written before Dumbledore died. Obviously, like, this is already the plan in motion.
Yes.
Harry was supposed to know the sword was going to come to him, and now Snape's going to have it. Are you kidding me? So what Dumbledore is planning is for Harry to disarm Snape, get the sword, and in doing so, also win the allegiance of the Elder Wand in that moment. So that later on, when Voldemort kills Snape, it won't matter because Harry's already the master. And when they have their big duel, the Elder Wand will backfire because Harry's the master and Voldemort will kill himself and Harry's soul will remain intact.
Yes.
Which is like, it is so elegant when you think about it like that. Like, and that's basically what he planned, because he wants Snape to give him the sword. He planned on Voldemort killing Snape to get the wand. Like, it's all right there. Obviously, things go askew. They end up working out exactly that way anyway.
They end up working out that way by a much more convoluted version of events.
Yes.
Which is, you know, Harry's physical disarming of Draco Malfoy's other wand, which
right.
then makes Harry master of all wands that Draco was ever the master of in the first place.
Very silly.
I would make 12 episodes just about Elder Wand lore, so.
But that is what our interpreted Dumbledore's plan for book 7 was, for Harry to be able to survive his encounter with Voldemort without becoming a murderer himself, because the wand would just backfire.
Yes, yes. So at the end of the day, it's wild, all of the different kinds of like social gameplay that Dumbledore is having to go to in order to manipulate the set of events, whether he's living or not, in the hopes that people will behave in a way that is in keeping with their behaviors, or in particular Voldemort's behaviors.
Right.
You know, it's like if he knows that he's going to, you know, go after the wand, how do you ensure this? And it's even interesting as well, because like, you know, there is the big conversation of like Hallows versus Horcruxes in the end, and how, you know, Dumbledore had you know, kind of guiltily sought the Hallows, but that the one thing that he was permitted to do, and it was to take mastery of the Elder Wand, not to use it, but to sort of like tame it, and allow it to basically like exit with himself.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that would ultimately hopefully yield the destruction of what is otherwise a rather dangerous artifact. But the fact that Dumbledore, even in death, was still attempting to dictate the flow of the Elder Wand in the name of ultimate safety is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. Yeah. I don't know. There you go. That's Dumbledore's big plan in a nutshell as we press onward. Hopefully this was a fun little transition episode for you.
Yeah, no, it was really cool for me too. I mean, I feel like it has been, I think we started releasing Dumbledore's big plan back during the pandemic.
Yes, we did. Yeah, I remember writing it at home, and me and you would be on these long phone calls determining all the things that Dumbledore did. And
My gosh, yeah. I bought a whiteboard for my home for this show, so that while we were on those phone calls, I could literally be like, you'd be on speakerphone and I'd be like next to my computer and I'm like scribbling all over the board. And
yeah,
you know,
we weren't even in the same room writing it.
I know. So interestingly, this is probably the longest stretch of continuous conversation that wasn't recording the actual videos for Super Carlin Brothers, where we've talked about Dumbledore's big plan from start to finish.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. Like we never got to actually do this in person before.
I know. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, guys, yeah, Dumbledore's big plan. You will definitely hear us continuously bring it up, as well as many other theories that we've written throughout the years as we continue to work our way through the rest of the books. And first and foremost, of course, will be chapter number next, which is chapter one of Chamber of Secrets.
That's right. The worst birthday.
The worst birthday. I'm looking forward to it. I think that Chamber of Secrets is the book I have read the fewest times.
Oh, really?
I believe so.
All right. Well, this will be a very interesting read through.
I know. I'm pretty excited. And honestly, I feel like when it comes to trivia, like this is probably the one that I think I missed the most number of questions from, specifically because I've read it the fewest times. So I'm like gearing up for it. I got this. Let's go. This is going to be good. I'm going to be so much more equipped for everything that ever happens in the future. Which is going to be, it's going to be super great. So as ever, guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and
we'll see you next time through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.